Letter number 86, for October 5th, 1941. All the signs on the physical plane indicate that the war has rounded the turning point and is entering upon its penultimate phase, though it could still be thrown away by weakness and folly, of which we must take heed that we are not guilty. A new danger will threaten us, however, as it becomes apparent that the military might of Germany has shot its bolt. There are two schools of thought in the entourage of the Führer: those who believe in the invincibility of physical force and rely on mundane plan organization to achieve their ends, and the relatively small and apparently obscure group of those who realize that there are subtle forces that can be enlisted to serve their ends. Hitler himself uses both as his instruments. It is difficult to see how far he has an accurate knowledge of technical occultism and how far, as in military matters, he avails himself of the services of experts. In any case, he himself is a natural occultist and highly developed medium. We should probably not be far from the mark if we said that he has a natural flair for occult matters but has been at no pains to master the laborious technicalities of magic and relies on others for the working out of the details. That he employs astrologers to work out the timing of his strokes is well established and a matter of common knowledge, but it is doubtful, knowing as much as he does, this is the only line of occultism along which he works. In his book Strange Conflict, Dennis Wheatley deals with the possibility of the employment of telepathic mind reading for the penetration of state secrets, and any student of the occult knows that such a thing is not only possible, but far from improbable. We ourselves received 3 days' warning of the outbreak of hostilities. But telepathic suggestion is just as much a fact as telepathic mind reading, and we should do well to consider the possibilities it presents and the means of defense against them, for as the physical plane might of Germany declines, so will the influence of its exponents, and the Führer will turn increasingly to those who wield the invisible weapons, and they are quite capable of snatching victory out of defeat after the war has been lost on the physical plane. We might very well be robbed of the fruits of victory in the very hour of our triumph by the apparently unaccountable aberrations of our leaders, who would allow a Germany on the verge of breaking, but not actually broken, to slip through their fingers, retreat and rearm. Then there would be another war in 10 years' time, and we should not win it. There is only one defense against such subtle methods working in darkness, and that is to dig them up and expose them to the light of the sun. For light destroys the creatures of darkness, being inimical to their nature. Suggestion, however subtle, is useless against the person who knows it is being employed. If the possibility is realized, people can be on their guard against it. Is such a danger real or fantastic? Let me give an example. It will be recalled that shortly after the outbreak of war there was for several weeks an epidemic of thefts of important secret documents from attaché cases left in unattended cars. Then the epidemic ceased as suddenly as it had begun. For such an epidemic the following factors were necessary: I. The leaving of important documents in cars on a wholesale scale. 2. The presence on the spot on each occasion of a car thief interested in official secrets and capable of realizing their value when he saw them, for the ordinary car thief pitches mere papers into the nearest bushes if he has the misfortune to steal them in mistake for valuables. How are we to explain such phenomenal absent-mindedness on the part of custodians of important papers, plus the presence on the spot of a specialist thief? Would not telepathic suggestion account for the happenings more satisfactorily than any other hypothesis? How can not only those in high positions, but the individual voter who is an important person in a democracy, avoid being caught in this invisible snare? In one way only: the traditional magical manner, by swearing the oath of the operation. This is done by defining the nature of the work undertaken and laying down its conditions in principle and in detail, and swearing a solemn oath not to depart one hair's breadth from them, whatever may be the confusions and temptations. In our case, the oath of the operation is the Atlantic Charter. Every man, woman, and child ranged on the side of the free nations against Hitler's new order ought to acquaint themselves thoroughly with the terms of that agreement and the nature of the principles involved, and resolve in their hearts that in no circumstances and for no considerations whatever will they swerve from them by a hair's breadth. Let them realize that the subtlest and the most forcible temptations to compromise will come to them, not only in the form of considerations of expediency and threats, but disguised as ideals, the voice of conscience, the promptings of mercy, and even psychic intuitions, in fact especially the latter. Compromise will be in the air as soon as the military defeat of Germany is a certainty. There is only one defense against the potent and visible influences that will then commence coming over on the ether in concentrated form, the strict, blind, even fanatical observance of the oath of the operation, for when that intangible bombardment begins, we shall be too bemused to be capable of judgment. The 12th of October 1941, this week mud and rain slows down there, German advance towards Moscow. By now, German forces are within 60 miles of the Russian capital. The deep and sinister matters of the previous letter are pursued in the one that follows, and Dion Fortune goes on, in the very explicit terms, to describe how such dangers may be guarded against. Letter number 87, for October 12, 1941. Those who have read last week's letter will no doubt have realized from incidents within their own observation the truth it indicates. We have only to look backwards over the record of British policy during and immediately preceding the war to realize that some abnormal influence was at work, for human fatuity could hardly have touched such depths unaided. No one suggests, nor I think, would anyone believe, that English statesmen and diplomats were got at through the commonplace channels of corruption. What then was the nature of the influence that undermined their judgment? For this war ought never to have occurred, and need never have occurred if a normal standard of common sense had prevailed in high places. How did it come about that a man of the caliber of Mr. Sikael Gruber, presiding over a state with a record like Germany's, could mislead men of the caliber of the leaders of the British people? The power of democratic leadership is not found in insensitive persons with insulated minds, and the awareness of subtle influences which makes them able to discern the signs of the times renders them vulnerable to the impact of forces deliberately transmitted over that subtle mental radio which can be operated by trained minds. It is no use stigmatizing such an operation as black magic, for this mental radio is as impersonal as Marconi's invention. It is this power that we ourselves make use of in our group meditations week by week, but we endeavor to use it in humility and dedication and self-examination, for no personal or national end, but for the good of all living beings, working for national purposes because we believe the group soul of the British people to be dedicated to the service of God insofar as the group mind can conceive it. It is our task, being students of the secret wisdom, to use the knowledge our studies have yielded us to aid in the carrying out of the cosmic law, humbly before God, but with the courage of our convictions before our fellow men. There are methods known in the secret tradition which can be used, and it is our task to use them. We too can evoke primordial energies from the primitive levels of the national group soul and harness them to archetypal ideas in the group mind of the race. Let us consider the method to be employed. When the Germans open up the primordial levels of their racial mind, they release the elemental energies of the old gods, the blood-stained, mindless images of the heroes of Norse myth. Do we necessarily fight them with their own weapons? Far otherwise. The Celts of these islands were among the earliest to be Christianized, as the Germans were among the latest. A good 1,000 years intervenes between the conversion of Britain and the conversion of Germany, consequently the influences of Christianity reaches to a far deeper level of racial consciousness with us than with them, and when the surface consciousness of the British group soul peels off, we find, not the mindless heroes of Valhalla, but the chivalry of the Table Round, Excalibur instead of Nut Hung, and the quest of the Grail instead of the looting of the Runagold. Let us wake from their long sleep the primordial images of our race, King Arthur and his knights, with the wisdom of Merlin to guide them. These shall keep the soul of England against the invisible influences being brought to bear upon it for its undoing. Let the folly of the pre-war years, during which the soul of England lay in a drugged sleep, give place to the ideal of chivalry. We know now what the drug was, and how the drugging was done. We need not fall victim again. Let an ideal, clearly held, guard the soul of England against insidious propaganda. Let the archetypal images of the Age of Faith arise to guide us, and the primordial energies of our ancient race be loosed on a quest. The 2nd of November 1941, this week the Germans stop their land attack on Moscow to wait for the ground to harden. Meanwhile the Luftwaffe relentlessly bomb the city. In her 90th letter, Dion Fortune extends the question of self-protection from the nation to the individual. This instruction is probably as valuable as anything she wrote in her earlier popular book Psychic Self-Defense. Letter number 90, for November 2, 1941. We have recently pointed out in plain terms that the knowledge of mind power can be used for attack as well as defense, and that our enemies are well known to have access to the occult methods. Occultism is neither foolproof nor knave-proof, it is simply knowledge of certain little understood aspects of the human mind, and can be used for good or evil according to the motives that inspire it. Our own methods can be turned against us unless we understand the use of the shield as well as the sword. It has been suggested that in attacking our antagonists openly as we have done, we render ourselves liable to a deliberate riposte. This is a suggestion that cannot be brushed aside with platitudes, but must be taken seriously. Of course we can be attacked, and if we are accomplishing anything effectual, an attack will certainly be made. What is the best defense against such an attack? For the faint-hearted, the best defense is to drop all contact with the fraternity of the inner light, and run away, removing their precious skins to a place of safety, if they can find one. This is the best thing for them, and the best thing for us, for there is no efficient defense for the faint-hearted in these matters. There is, however, a perfectly efficient defense for the courageous and dedicated. Just as the sin, if unbroken, offers a strong defense against contagion, so the surface of the aura is as resistant as plate glass when hardened for defense, for the citadel of the soul can only be betrayed from within. If we react to an attack, we open the gates; if we do not react, the forces sent against us recoil from the glassy surface of the aura and return to those that sent them like an AA shell that has failed to explode. The best way to stiffen the resistive surface of the aura is to raise the magnetic pressure inside. This is done by invocation. Realize that in using our knowledge of mind power in the fight for what we believe to be right, we are not relying on our own resources, but making channels of ourselves for spiritual forces coming down from a higher plan and directed by a higher wisdom. We are neither going in our own strength nor acting on our own judgment, but have dedicated ourselves to the service of the one good, which is God, even to the point of the final sacrifice. It is not our personal activities that stir up opposition and invite retaliation, it is the forces of cosmic law that are using us as channels, and these are fully able to protect the channels they are using from any attack that can be made upon them. Realizing this, we shall see that there is no occasion to feel fear; we are invulnerable to a frontal attack. Before and after meditation, and on going to bed at night, we should remind ourselves of this protection. If there should be any definite sense of attack, imagine yourself standing before the Rose Cross in the cavern under the Hill of Vision, see the doors opening and the ray of light shining in, and those entering, who come to meet us in the light. Imagine yourself speaking to them, tell them what you feel, and ask for their protection. We should be interested to know if anyone has occasion to use this method, and the results they get. There are possibilities of flank attacks, however, to which we need to be alive. The fear-inspiring threat of indiscriminate bombing has been tried, and has failed. Despite its physical effects, it was purely psychological warfare, for its effect on our war effort was negligible. We need now to begin our preparations to meet what will surely come their flank attacks on morale, the familiar pincer movement repeated on the inner planes. These attacks rely on the principle that good is the enemy of the best. It would be good to stop the war at once, but it would be better to make sure of a permanent peace by fighting it to a conclusive finish. Since we have shown ourselves so notably unresponsive to psychological warfare based on terrorist principles, an appeal to a notoriously sentimental idealism will be attempted. In combating this, we shall need great wisdom, For there is a true idealism of which we must not lose sight while refusing to allow the wool to be pulled over our eyes by specious statements of false idealism. In this matter, the principle of justice is our best guide. There can be no compromise on this point, especially where other people's rights are concerned. I should like to take this opportunity of assuring our friends that the rumor that I am suffering from a general breakdown brought on by the intensity of my inner plane activities in the defense of England does not correctly describe the situation. The trouble is not generalized, but localized in my nose, and the symptoms are those of the common cold. While I would be willing to believe anything of Hitler in the way of frightfulness, I think that in this instance he should be given the benefit of the doubt and the trouble attributed to natural causes. I do not know of anything that could have given rise to this rumour, but in the light of the matters we have concerned in this letter, I conclude that the wish was father to the thought. The 7th of December 1941, suffering in conditions so cold that their weapons cease, the German army is dramatically pushed back by a secretly gathered army of Russians. The Germans had been within 12 miles of the Kremlin. Towards the end of 1941, Dion Fortune announced the re-establishment of the inner aspects of her work, which meant less participation by her in elementary teaching activity. In her description of the work in hand, she again gives an excellent cameo of the work of a dedicated occult group. Letter number 95, for December 7, 1941. A great deal of reorganization is going on in our work, necessitating my partial withdrawal from outer court activities, and I feel that some explanation is due to the friends who have been attending my lectures on Sunday mornings. Although we had to restrict our activities owing to the blackout and the dispersal of our workers, we carried on right through the Blitz by temporarily combining our inner and outer court, so that those who come to the open meetings on Sundays were invited to participate in inner group meditation work. We are, however, essentially an organization for intensive training, not for propaganda work, and with the return of less strenuous conditions we are resuming our original functions. As always, our study courses are open to all serious students, but we shall not be doing the deeper work or giving the deeper teaching in the public lectures of the outer court any longer. Meanwhile, those who have learnt our meditation methods are asked to carry on as heretofore with the weekly work. I have already said, our work as an organization has been the intensive training of advanced students, and we have had no contact with the general public. Those who came to us coming either as a result of reading my books or through personal introduction. In order to give the advanced training, however, it was necessary to recover a great many of the lost secrets of the mystery tradition, for so many had been lost that the system was for all practical purposes inoperative and largely unintelligible. In order to carry out this work, I have only sought for a sufficient number of students of a suitable type to assist me with the research work, and never made any attempt to draw large numbers around me, propaganda not being my work. Sufficient students of the right type, however, have never been easy to find, even among the most enthusiastic, and there have been many disappointments on both sides. This, I hope, involves no odium. It certainly does not on our side, for people may do good work with other organizations who are unsuited to ours. Unfortunately, there have been from time to time people who have found it hard to forgive us our exacting standard. I would point out, however, that if we are to have anything worth giving to worthwhile people, we must exact a high standard, and that an organization doing practical work cannot afford to carry more than a very limited amount of dead weight in the form of passengers, who, however sincerely interested they may be, either cannot make, or do not desire to fulfill the conditions requisite for making any active psychic contribution to our work. Up to the outbreak of the war, we were occupied with gathering the battered remains of the mystery tradition, piecing them together, and interpreting them to modern thought in terms of psychology. The basis of this work rested on the papers left behind by the late MacGregor Mathers, founder of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, a complete set of which are in my possession, though I had not got permission to publish them. They were, however, subsequently published by Israel Righardi in four volumes under the title of The Golden Dawn. Those who have had access to these very valuable volumes will realize how much work was necessary to reconstruct the lost verbal tradition and provide the necessary practical experience to enable the practical work to be carried out effectually and make of it a reality instead of a vain observance. It will be many a long day, and require the cooperation of many persons with highly specialized qualifications, before this work can be considered complete, if it ever is. For fresh vistas open as one advances, but substantial progress has been made, and is in process of making, and in the fruits of this and in further research we invite the cooperation of those who are willing to work at the matter systematically and seriously. I shall not, however, in future, be speaking in public oftener than once a month, though the Sunday morning lectures will continue with other speakers. Particulars of the program for next term will be sent in due course to all those whose addresses we have. During the blackout, our activities must necessarily be limited, but as the days grow longer in the spring, they will be again extended. The research work, and the work of building up a mystery school and method of systematic training, will continue as heretofore, and we shall also continue our meditation work in support of the aims set forth in the Atlantic Charter. In this, all who will can aid, whether they be members of our organization or not, and these letters will continue to be sent out weekly in order to coordinate their efforts. The 14th of December 1941, 6 days ago, Japan attacked the American Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor in the Hawaiian Islands. By the time of writing her 96th letter, the war had extended yet further, with the coming in of Japan and war in the Pacific. In taking note of this, Diane Fortune makes some useful observations about the difference between psychism and seership, and their relation to the foreseeing of coming events. Letter number 96, for December 14, 1941. Since our last letter was written and dispatched, the picture presented by the war has changed notably. It has now spread right round the globe and can justly be termed a world war and not a European war, a title which has hitherto been withheld from it despite the wise words that peace is one and indivisible. This new development brings to the forefront the question of prophecy, which is often raised in connection with the teachings received from the inner planes. Why do not the masters, if they are what they are presumed to be, exercise the power of prophecy for the benefit of humanity? The answer is that they do, but they seldom set time limits for the working out of their prognostications, so that although the esoteric teachings afford valuable information for the planning of strategy, they give little help in the devising of tactics. In other words, the teaching received from the masters is a guide to long-distance planning, but leaves immediate problems to the exercise of judgment and initiative on the physical plane. It would be difficult to conceive a wiser policy, for it gives guidance in questions of principle without which men must stumble blindly, and leaves us to benefit by the exercise of responsibility. It will be remembered that throughout the dubious developments of 1939 and the dark experiences of 1941, the tone of these letters never varied. The question of the ultimate outcome of the war and the form of the final peace was never considered a matter for speculation because it was taken for granted. Well-informed persons shrugged their shoulders, but time is justifying that attitude. It is a curious fact that all the pessimism was in high places, the mass of the people of Britain, relying on instinct instead of information, took the same view that we, guided by seership, were led to take. Exact information can be very misleading because it only takes account of what is already in manifestation on the physical plane, and makes no allowance for imponderable psychological factors and the subtle forces of the inner planes, which are the planes of causation, where all things brew before they come through to the physical plane. The psychic looks beyond the realms of material manifestation and sees the shape of things to come a little while before they manifest. Consequently, he can make exact prophecies if he is able to assess the relative influence of the various factors involved. The seer, however, works differently. His vision operates on the plane of remote causation and he sees primary causes at work. In consequence, he can foretell the end result of tendencies as they work out in the epochs of history, but has little guidance to offer on the day-to-day movements of events. The 21st of December 1941, President Roosevelt is given extraordinary war powers by Congress and lowers the minimum age for military service to 19. The role of a working group is reiterated in the following letter and the importance of its contact with the masters or elder brethren upon the inner planes. Letter number 97, for December 21st, 1941. The work which we are engaged in doing in our meditation group is not a rule of thumb affair. It is based on the profound philosophic principles of the esoteric tradition. It is not possible in these letters to make a study for these principles in their entirety, but enough must be said for the rationale of our work to be understood so that those who are taking part can cooperate intelligently and use the powers made available for us to the best advantage. We conceive of God as the great unmanifest and therefore transcending human realization and only to be known by deduction from his manifestation in the cosmos, which we conceive as a projected thought form of the divine mind. We conceive of sparks from the divine fire which is the great unmanifest as forming the nuclei of the souls of men. These nuclei build up individual consciousness through the experiences of independent existence in manifestation. They develop up to a certain point under the complete control of cosmic law, such law having been built up in the course of previous evolutions, but after a certain point they have to go forward under their own guidance and power in order to achieve the higher ranges of development open to them as the sons of God, that is to say, as sparks from the divine fire, and therefore of the same nature as the great unmanifest. It is here that evil, or unbalanced force, enters in. For just as the child crawling about the floor and learning to walk is at a disadvantage as compared with the child lying safely in the comfort of the cradle, so the infant humanity progressing painfully towards self-conscious, self-controlled adulthood is at a disadvantage as compared with the mindless spiritual beings of the Golden Age. Nevertheless, without this painful phase of learning by experience, mankind could never achieve spiritual adulthood and responsibility. We know only too well the kind of personality that results when an adolescent is denied all opportunity for experience and treated as a child by unwise parents. There is also a form of insanity which consists in the refusal to face life and a return to the infantile attitude. Both these things we see in the life of nations as well as individuals, and they help to explain what is happening in the world today. We know that children are not left to learn by their own unaided experience, but that adults take on the task of teaching them the cultural heritage of the race. This takes place also on group level. There are teachers of mankind, handing on the accumulated experience of previous evolutions, and these we call the masters or elder brethren. They are of human, not the angelic evolution, and are disembodied minds existing on the inner planes. They guide and teach by projecting thought telepathically, relaying the archetypal ideas of the divine mind. People who are sensitive to spiritual influences receive these ideas subconsciously and begin to act upon them without realizing whence they come. They receive them as general principles, however, not as concrete direction of policy. People with psychic development perceive these influences more clearly, according to their degree of development. The highly trained initiates of the occult schools are in direct and conscious touch with the masters. Thus is it possible for humanity to receive guidance insofar as it is capable of profiting by such guidance, and it is not left to grope unaided. Our work as a group consists in maintaining contact with the masters on the inner planes so that this guidance and teaching can come through. In order to do this, we have to maintain certain conditions at our headquarters, and this demands the services of a certain number of carefully chosen and highly trained people. In order to discover and develop such servers, we maintain an outer court and training school. The 25th of January 1942, the first American troops arrive on British soil. I have heard it said that Diane Fortune, in her social attitudes, was something of a snob. This would hardly seem to be supported by her trenchant remarks about social privilege in her 100th letter. She also gives some hard practical advice on how to help remedy things, although not by going to the barricades. Letter number 100, for January 25th, 1942.